The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
What's next? I think there is tremendous opportunities. If you have a significant position in cash and a significant position in metals, I think you're perfectly poised to put those assets to work for you in productive assets in the years ahead. And I think you're going to be able to do it not only here in the U.S. markets, but in the overseas markets, maybe even in the Chinese markets, for pennies in the dollar.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You're headed to China, Dave, and so we wanted to get this program in before you left. Just a little bit of a recap. Some of our listeners were here this last week, and you had private meetings with them. You gave a presentation of where the economy is, and then you met with each of them privately about their own portfolios. I know we can't be privy to all of those conversations, but what I wanted to do was, for those who could not come, today I'd like to spend some time before you leave for China asking the questions that your clients privately asked you when they were meeting with you.
You know, by far the biggest concern was with the U.S. dollar and what are the implications of the Chinese beginning to devalue. And I think you can see some parallels between the Chinese liberalization of the control of their currency to what we had with the exchange rate mechanism and its break in 92, right, even going further back in time to 71, where we moved off the gold standard as we had committed to make payment of debts in gold to other central banks, and they took us up on it. We went from 25,000 tons down to about 8,600 tons. You could count it in months. Maybe it stretched over a two-year period, but a very short period of time, and our gold holdings were being gutted because people understood that the value of the dollar, following the guns and butter policies of the Johnson administration, was already headed down, and this promise to support the dollar with gold was going to be short-lived. And I think the Chinese have basically concluded the same thing, as we've seen with the ERM, again, the exchange rate mechanism going back to 92. These are major changes in the currency world, which have very significant ramifications for the rest of the world, and I think our clients were right to ask, what does this mean for us?
Well, when you look behind the curtain and you see where all the gold, virtually all the gold's been going for the last few years, you can see that the Chinese are preparing to lay a base for their monetary system in something other than just paper. You were talking about 1971. I know by August 14th, 1971, the day before Nixon closed the gold window, there was as much as 15 tons of gold an hour coming out of Fort Knox. And a lot of it was going into French hands, British hands, people who were cashing in their dollars for gold, seeing the handwriting on the wall.
A few weeks ago, we talked about how this was just an exacerbation of a major currency war. And it really is. If you think about the first shots fired, it really was the U.S. through their various programs, quantitative easing programs and whatnot, that got a major devaluation globally kicked off. Mm. And that's been continued. You see it, and you have seen it in China. You've seen it in Europe. You've seen it in Japan. It is a global issue, and the ramifications are pretty significant. One of the things we spent some time talking about was, you know, since the beginning of the millennium, 2000 to the present, we've seen very tepid, very mild growth in the global equities markets, whether we're talking about the Japanese Nikkei or the German DAX or the French CAC or the British FTSE 100. You know, these are indexes which have struggled. They've struggled since the beginning of the millennium. And what they've struggled with is an economy which is laden with debt, and we're talking about each of these individually. Now, when we got to 2008 and 2009, where we were challenged by, you know, systemic issues and risk within the system, starting with the mortgage-backed securities market in the United States, but ultimately creating major liquidity issues in the financial institution, it was at its root a debt problem. We issued a lot of debt, and we did it irresponsibly. And of course, Moody's and Fitch and S&P were there to rubber stamp the AAA grade on things that were really junk in nature. But nevertheless, it was a debt issue. And what we have today is clearly an even bigger debt issue. And it's one of the reasons why economies around the world are struggling to regain sort of the 1990s growth strength and trajectory that you saw in that time frame.
Well, and when you go into debt, Dave, you have to have someone to loan you money. And historically, over the last 40 years or so, the lenders to at least the United States have been the Chinese. And you were mentioning to me that close to 40% of the world's growth has come from China, and now China's slowing down. Hence, part of the reason for your trip to China.
You know, one of the things that I think people forget is that debt is really nothing more than pulling consumption forward in time, or pulling growth forward in time. And so you end up getting greater growth and greater consumption in the now, but it basically takes its toll in the future. And that's what we're living with.
The future is now.
The future is now.
Yeah.
And so it should come as no surprise that we have lower growth rates, given the fact that, listen, we're now in the future, and the higher growth rates of yesteryear, those benefits, quite frankly, were artificial in nature because they were so debt dependent and debt driven. The topic of conversation, I think, amongst many of our clients, they were concerned about how dependent we were on central bank activism. And, you know, what do we mean by that exactly? Well, you look at how involved the world central banks are in sort of driving growth and in propping up the system. And it really has been the linchpin for our current perceptions of stability.
Mm-hmm.
I say perceptions of stability because it's not as if central bank activity is driving economic growth. It's driving certain litmus tests, which would give people greater confidence. So, for instance, the Dow, it's up. Okay, well, then all must be well. That is a contrived, determined conclusion. And I say determined because that's what you are supposed to conclude.
Right.
So it's one of those tools that's used, again, in a vast PR campaign to bring people back to the market, bring them back as consumers. But again, we're still dealing with paying back the last round of overconsumption. Adding to it is tougher than it might seem.
Well, and the central banks have manipulated markets and manipulated the signals that would warn us of risk. You know, interest rates are probably one of the most important measurements of risk. And, you know, Dave, I think back when our house was first built, there were smoke alarms in every room. Okay, now we have a vaulted ceiling, and I can tell you that some of the smoke alarms were put in very inconvenient places. One night, we did not have a fire. I still don't know what happened, but every one of those alarms went off at 3 a.m, and I could not get them to shut off, and it took me forever to get to the one with the vaulted ceiling. So I finally pulled it down.
Was it a BB gun or a 22? I mean, eventually you just start blasting, don't you?
I broke a number of them to get them to shut up. I mean, I didn't understand even after I pulled them off. Yeah. So, but that's what the central banks are doing. Now, I knew we didn't have a fire. I checked everything first and I disabled the smoke alarms. Now, I did not re-enable the ones that I couldn't get to.
Well, see, this is why interest rates are so important, because interest rates send a very clear signal in terms of both credit risk and duration risk. Duration risk being sort of, you know, you pay more for money that you're borrowing on a longer duration. 10 years is going to be paid more than 5 years, and 30-year paper is going to pay even more in terms of a rate of interest.
Right.
There's added risk given that duration that's involved. Credit risk too. But, you know, when we see governments doubling down, so to say, and adding to their debt. Global government debt is now 40 to 50% more than what we had prior to the global financial crisis. Global government debt's now well over $100 trillion. And a part of the reason why they've doubled down on their debt is they have bought down the interest rate. And, you know, what you're getting at in suggesting, you know, a fire alarm is there to send a warning signal. And, you know, what they've effectively done in buying down the rate is eliminate the sound signal. Interest rates tell you if there's a problem with you having committed too long or too much in terms of credit risk.
Right.
Will you get paid back is the question. And interest rates are an indication of the market voting. Yes or no, you will get paid back, or you're actually going to take a haircut. And so that's why I think this interest rate problem, it's more than just households being unable to generate income off of their savings. It's more than that. Because again, risk has been silenced, and that's a very significant problem moving forward.
One of the things that I know you were sharing, Dave, is that the debt that was held, let's say, by banks and Wall Street back in 2007, 2008, actually, a lot of the banks and Wall Street firms have gotten out of debt. Their debt has dropped, but it's been transferred to government entities, both the government and the Federal Reserve. So it's not as if the debt was erased. It's that the taxpayer now has assumed that debt.
Yeah, well, exactly. In a post-crisis environment, we've seen debt grow significantly in the shadow banking area. That is sort of lending that is not inside your traditional banking arenas. You know, it could be everything from a hard money lender to, you know, private equity group that is financing a particular project. Financing that is not through your traditional banks or Wall Street firms is considered shadow banking. And you're now at $24 trillion. That's just the U.S. portion. If you looked at it globally, it'd be closer to $75 trillion. Federal Reserve balance sheet has continued to expand. And quite frankly, that's allowed for a reduction of debt within your financials. That is your banks and Wall Street firms. They've been regulated. The banks and Wall Street firms have been required to improve their capital numbers and decrease their risk. And in the process of doing that, they've been able to offload some risky paper onto the U.S. government and Federal Reserve. And they have less debt today than they did before the global financial crisis. Households have reduced their debt only marginally, just a very small amount. Corporations have increased. Of course, the U.S. government has blown the top off in terms of adding new debt to old. We told you what it was in aggregate for the world, now over $100 trillion of global government debt. But the U.S. government, of course, has gone from $9 trillion to over $18 trillion. And the issue is quite simple. You can continue to expand debt if your plan is to not pay it back.
Right.
But responsibly, if you're going to pay it back, there are limits that you want to set in place that moderate the commitments that you're making. And I think this is the reality. They know the plan is not to pay it back. And that's either going to be because some of these things simply fall out in the context of a deflationary erasure, or with other liabilities. We've said this before, it's easy to pay back with cheaper and cheaper currency units. And the world is doing that. It's not just us, it's the whole wide world with central banks from the People's Bank of China, the Bank of Japan, the ECB, the Fed, you name it. They know that debt, the burden of it, is reduced when you inflate it away. So the consternation of some of your member countries in the euro has to do with having to go the route of austerity rather than money printing. So it's very interesting to watch the Greeks, to watch the Irish, to watch the Portuguese, to watch the Spanish harken back to yesteryear when they could, if they got behind, just run the printing presses. They handed over their monetary sovereignty and thus the easy fix to a debt problem of paying it back with cheaper and cheaper currency units. But the rest of the world is going to do it.
And there's only three ways to get rid of debt. You either pay it back, which you said is impossible. The other two are default on the debt. You know, Bill King talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Or, like you said, you just inflate it away with cheaper and cheaper currency. Now, we were talking about the Chinese originally here as we started the program. You're headed over there. The Chinese are starting to get sick of the inflated away with cheaper and cheaper dollars. And, you know, they've gone to the IMF, as we talked about before, and asked to be part of the SDR system. They were snubbed to a degree and put off until 2016. But the Chinese are trying to assert their currency as a major world reserve currency. That changes the whole game when it does happen.
When it happens simultaneously with a reduction in U.S. treasuries, you can begin to see sort of a double impact to the U.S. dollar. Not only do we have to share space on the die, so to say, where we're standing in front of the crowd, and now instead of being the only ones on the podium, at the podium, there's three or four or five, you know, we are reduced in our importance by being averaged down in terms of that basket of world currencies. If we used to be 60 or 70%, ultimately if we're 30 or 40%, it doesn't mean that the dollar goes away, but it does mean in real terms that the U.S. household loses 20, 30, 40% of their wherewithal. Is that catastrophic? Well, actually, for the middle class, it is. If you live from paycheck to paycheck, it absolutely does matter that your lifestyle takes a 25 to 40% hit. Now, I think the people that it doesn't really affect are the poor. Why? Because you can increase your entitlement spending and they won't necessarily know the difference. Government cheese is government cheese. Maybe they change the packaging, but you still will get it. Maybe the food value, the actual value of it goes down. And the wealthy, I don't think, will be bothered by a 30% reduction in living standard. There's enough cushion there. But you are talking about changes that are afoot that basically add to the pressure and ultimately the elimination of the middle class in America.
Well, China and Japan have been net buyers of treasuries for many years, and now we're starting to see dumps. I mean, China dumped how many billion?
Year to date, 180 billion they've let go. It has not affected the dollar. It has not affected the treasury market, in part because of what we mentioned a moment ago. The financials here in the United States, that is, banks and Wall Street firms, are improving, quote unquote, improving their balance sheet by getting rid of riskier loans. Those things can go to the Federal Reserve or third parties, shadow banking entities, who will try to take on a little bit more risk for the return involved. And those banks and Wall Street firms are picking up the slack, so to say. You dump $180 billion of treasuries onto the market, and banks who are being told they need more treasuries on their balance sheet to meet certain capital requirements are only too happy to buy them. Now, what's interesting, though, is it's your big banks and Wall Street firms that will be the large sponges to soak up that supply of treasuries. By the way, June, Japan was in the same boat, $9.6 billion. I think it was 9.6 or 9.8.
Where they were dumping treasuries?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, right now, you have a sponge which is dry and able to soak it up. I think one of the things that is concerning to me is if your small and medium-sized banks, call it your local or regional banks, have to do the same, it's going to cost them tremendously in terms of their net interest margin.
Yeah, the interest rates are virtually zero for these treasuries.
Right.
So if you're small, you need that kind of income.
That's right. The long-term implications for the small to medium-sized bank as they see their net interest margins shrink is that ultimately they go the way of the dodo bird and are absorbed by the too-big-to-fail banks. So seeing greater consolidation in the banking industry over the next 5 to 10 years, I think, is inevitable. Maybe even the next 1 to 2 years. We already know 30 to 60% is the expansion in footprint of your too-big-to-fail entities. They were too big prior to the global financial crisis. Now they're even bigger by 30 to 60%. And with new bank regulations requiring cleaned up capital requirements, capital levels, et cetera, the small to medium-sized bank is going to have a very hard time existing.
Well, for perspective, Dave, you know, if we're in a recovery, we can, in some ways, grow our way out of some of this debt. But if we're not in a recovery, you know, there have been some false starts as far as recessions and recoveries over the last 5 years. But where are we at right now? Because it feels like, and you talked about this last week, that we're slipping back into another recession.
You know, we've sat out much of the rise in equities the last several years. Our posture has been very defensive. And part of that is looking at the cycles. Normal business cycle, we were veering into recession in 2011, 2012, 2013. And according to the Economic Cycles Research Institute, we're on the verge of entering another recession right now here in 2015. Well, what did not materialize in 2011, 12, 13, and what may not materialize now? Well, again, this goes back to the issue of central bank activism. When you have governments buying government bonds, buying asset-backed securities, buying corporate bonds, buying stocks, I mean, imagine this. Imagine a world in which the Swiss government, through its central bank, is buying stocks.
Right.
And corporate bonds and government bonds, where the ECB is buying corporate bonds and government bonds, where the Japanese central bank, the BOJ, is buying government bonds, asset-backed securities, corporate bonds, and stocks in order to prop up prices. Does this strike you as odd? Does this strike you as funny? Does this strike you as normal? Does this strike you as sustainable?
It's the socialization of the world, Dave. I mean, the market is going away.
It's the socialization of the capital markets, which is very damaging to the capital markets, and raises this issue of, are we now in a brave new world where the business cycle no longer exists, where there's only tulips coming up tomorrow and roses coming up tomorrow? There is no winter. It's only summer always.
Doesn't that overprice the market, Dave? When the government has to come in and buy to keep markets stabilized, just like China did a couple of weeks ago.
Well, and this is where I turn back to, again, the ECRI reports. The Economic Cycles Research Institute has been raked over the coals by the news media saying, you guys just don't know anything. You've been around for 50 years. You've called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 8 recessions going back to the 1970s, and you nailed it. And yet here in the new era, you don't know what you're talking about. 11, you missed it. You thought there was going to be a recession. Was there? Of course not. 12, you were calling for a recession again. I think you guys at the ECRI are a bunch of negative Nancys. You know what they're looking at? They are looking at a normal business cycle. And the normal business cycle does not include extraordinary, never been done before central bank activism, the right kind that we have had in the last 5 to 7 years. Not only where, as we mentioned earlier, you've had a massive expansion of government debt, but that debt being raised has gone to some pretty interesting things. What are these central banks doing buying stocks? I mean, 24 different instances of intervention in China just to hold up the stock market, where they actually have a division of government which has spent close to $600 billion US in order to prop up the Shanghai stock market. Does that look normal to you? Does that sound normal to you? Does this look like the free markets? And I think that's where the ECRI would say, well, it's kind of tough. It's kind of tough when you're looking at historical things relating to a normal ebbs and flows of a business cycle to then take into account things that frankly aren't normal, aren't predictable, don't belong in the business cycle at all. And yet that's all we have today is intervention after intervention after intervention.
Well, the central banks have been the sugar daddy to the markets at this point. But if that effort to reflate fails, okay, let's say the market still comes down. Let's say we do go into a recession seriously. Do the central banks once and for all lose their credibility?
You know, I think this is one of the reasons why Stanley Druckenmiller just stepped into the gold market and bought 2.9 million shares of the exchange-traded fund, GLD. Why does he want several hundred million dollars in gold within his portfolio, amounting to over 20% of the assets?
Stanley Druckenmiller is the investor behind Soros, right?
Duquesne Capital was one of the operators, so to say, for the Soros funds. Going back decades, a good part of Soros's success was dependent on the keen execution at Duquesne at the direction of Stanley Druckenmiller. Mm-hmm. He got out of the markets in 2010, closed down Duquesne, turned to a family office, and has been managing his own money since then. Well, you know, putting several hundred million dollars into the gold market, I think this has a lot to do with looking at what happens when confidence in central banks comes into question. You're talking about a credibility issue. And if their efforts of the last 6 years to reflate the system, to reflate and avoid deflation, if they fail to keep us from deflation, you're not just dealing with a deflation problem. You're dealing with a central bank credibility problem,
right?
Because these guys have been treated as the masters of the universe. If in fact they move into, you know, sometimes we don't get it right. What does the general market begin to think and believe? Now you're talking about a crisis of faith. Why do I say a crisis of faith? Because the market has put faith in a few PhDs. Again, whether it's the Bank of Japan, the ECB, the Fed, a few PhDs which are being treated as if they have godlike capacity.
Well, and you look at the Federal Reserve just since 2008. I mean, the Federal Reserve had less than $1 trillion on their books in 2008. Now that's moved up more than fourfold. I mean, I think it's like $4.4 trillion. So their ability, they have shot a lot of bullets and they've pulled a lot of this debt onto their books. How much more can they do?
They can do an infinite amount. The question is, what are the consequences for doing so?
For the dollar.
Yeah, and that's where, again, during the periods of QE1, QE2, QE3, and 4, you know, QE1 overlapping late 2008 to early 2010, and then mostly 2011 for the second round of monetization of assets. And this is when, again, our central bank is out there buying agency debt, mortgage-backed securities, and treasuries, and then, you know, overlapping 2012 to almost the end of 2014 for QE3 and QE4, not only do you see a rise in the markets with every intervention, with every asset purchase, but yes, there is a real consequence to the value of the dollar and the consequence of QE1 through 4. they stop and the dollar begins to recover because there's less pressure on the dollar. And now it's the turn of every other central bank to do the same thing in terms of quantitative easing. And so we see on a relative basis the dollar moving up while those other currencies are moving down. What we have is, I think, a context where the next round, QE5, QE6, QE7, QE8, puts more pressure on the dollar. Why will they do that? Well, one, because they can. Two, because they have to. We're getting to a point where, again, you look at treasury rates today. Treasury rates are indicative of a perfect world, and yet we live in anything but a perfect world. You know, we've had a collapse in currencies in the emerging markets, anywhere from 20 to as much as 60% in a fairly short period of time. And, you know, we know from knowing how interconnected the world is, part of the success story of globalization, is that we are interconnected economically and financially. And it does mean that problems transmit. Problems are not nation-bound or nation-centric. A problem in China is a problem in the United States. A problem in Brazil is a problem in Argentina. These borders and boundaries do not somehow isolate us and keep us safe because capital flows. And to the degree that capital flows freely, these problems flow from one country to the next.
Yes, but you've brought up over the last month or two that if we were in any other country, Dave, let's take gold as a barometer for crisis. Okay, we were looking at interest rates, but gold as a barometer for crisis in every other currency worldwide, gold has been rising. Okay, but we here in our little bubble here in America, even though it does translate long term, we look at gold in dollar terms. And, you know, you've quoted Paul Volcker, who has been seen as a hero in the past of raising interest rates when he needed to back in the early 80s. Volcker said in his memoir that he should have broken the price of gold because that is the barometer people look at. When does the barometer start telling the truth with gold price relative to the dollar, not these other currencies?
Well, and this is where I think the average market practitioner who's just looking at, say, the Dow or the S&P and saying, all must be well because prices are high. What they don't understand is that most of your market signals, which tell you that risk is plentiful and increasing, those signals have been silenced. Those signals have been silenced. We talked about interest rates, have for a few minutes here. Do mortgage rates tell you that we've had a crisis in real estate here in the last 3 to 5 years?
Right, they don't.
They don't. I mean, you've got 30-year paper that's available for less than 4%. That's not a real rate. That's not a real rate. That doesn't indicate that we've just gone through a mortgage and real estate crisis here in the United States. That is not an appraisal of risk. That is a bought rate. That is a manipulated and contrived rate. Treasury rates, we already know that they're contrived.
Even junk bonds, corporate bonds, they're not telling the truth because you've got these altered rates from the government.
Well, that's exactly right. If you look at all rates as almost like a ladder, where the higher you go up the ladder, the greater the risk if you fall, it's almost as if we've taken the first 5 rungs of the ladder and just sunk them into the dirt, right? For all intents and purposes, being on a high rung of the ladder doesn't mean that you're taking any risk anymore. That's the impression in the market. There's another one that's, I think, very interesting. Not only interest rates and gold being signals which would tell you something bad is about to happen, but now you've got the New York Fed suggesting through Citadel. Citadel is one of the largest hedge funds in the world. Now it employs none other than Ben Bernanke.
Ben Bernanke. No conflict of interest there, by the way.
Zero. In fact, he said he's going to work with Citadel because he wouldn't want to work with a regulated entity. That might be a conflict. Mm. And yet here you have the New York Fed coming to Citadel and saying, we basically need you to manipulate the VIX futures. What is the VIX? The VIX is the volatility index. It's a ratio of puts and calls, and it is an indicator of concern in the marketplace. If someone thinks the stock market is going to sell off, they'll buy put options.
Right.
Why will they do that? Well, because you can make money if the market's going down.
Or if you think it's going to go up, you're going to buy calls.
Well, that's right. And so this volatility index will go to a higher number when there's concern in the marketplace. For the New York Fed to be suggesting, yeah, Citadel, why don't you just sit on this number? Again, it's the deadening of a signal. It goes back to you trying to just get that fire alarm to shut up.
Right.
Why? Well, you knew there wasn't a fire. But what if you did know that there was a fire and you wanted to control an outcome, control the traffic, control the response to that crisis?
Right.
I think they're also dealing with a credibility issue in the sense that if they can silence these signals, the volatility index, the bond market, and gold, if they can silence those signals, do you know what you end up with? Non-culpability. Nobody saw it coming.
Right.
When the next catastrophe occurs, when we have round two of the global financial crisis, who's responsible? Well, these guys were supposed to see it coming. We know they didn't see it coming last time, but they don't want to be thrown out in their keister for getting it wrong again. So you kill all the signals, and guess what happens? Oh, nobody could have seen it coming. But I'll tell you what, we've got all the answers to this problem right here, right now. We'll be happy to solve it. We just need more keys to the kingdom.
Well, one of the things you and I have talked about a number of times is how sad it is that income-starved investors, okay, let's take the average person who's retired, and they had enough money to retire. If they were retiring 15 years ago when interest rates were actually paying, they could actually live on their interest. But at this point, they're living on their principal. Income-starved investors, Dave, are being forced into these markets, and these markets are not looking like they're dangerous because that volatility index has been smoothed out to almost nothing.
Well, and the interest rates are also communicating to you that there's no risk in the marketplace. So between the central banks distorting the risk-free rate and altering all asset prices, that's a part of the issue, but you're exactly right. You also have investors who are saying, listen, I used to get 5% in the bank. Now I can't get half of 1% at the bank. Looks like I'm going to have to go elsewhere, whether that's buying equities or, again, lower quality fixed income to get that old 5%. And what are they doing? Well, two things. They're exaggerating the price trends in those risky asset markets, and they're also ignoring the greater portfolio risk now embedded in their savings and retirement assets. And you know what's going to happen? They're going to wake up one day, and those asset prices are going to prove to them what it means to be in something of lower quality.
Right. Not just lower quality, but lower liquidity.
Well, and lower price.
Yeah.
I mean, because ultimately what happens when you shift into something with greater volatility, lower quality, and higher risk, someday those chickens come home to roost. And what you thought was safe because you pegged it to some sort of a 5% number, which used to be the equivalent of a bank deposit, and that bank deposit you imply is safe, and now you've shifted asset classes to something that has the equivalent return, but five times the risk.
Right.
You know what happens? You don't have the resources that you need when you enter retirement, because like 2008, 2009, something surprising occurs.
Right.
And it shouldn't be a surprise, but it will be a surprise to most investors.
Something that actually exacerbates the fall when it happens is the margin that's built into the market. You know, Wall Street, the momentum players especially, they use margin to their advantage when it's going up or when the momentum's going their direction. And the margin we're talking about right now is at the highest level, really, any time in history.
Yeah, it's a combination of leveraged products. I mean, you can buy double, triple, insanely leveraged ETFs. Some of them are structured very well, and some of them are not structured well at all. And so you've got ETFs and mutual funds, which give traders the ability to take a position in an asset class. And you think as a trader, you've got a lot of liquidity. Maybe you don't. But you're right. The combination of lower liquidity, higher leverage, and leverage both in terms of the vehicles chosen, as well as actual money borrowed to be invested, that is your old margin debt numbers, $505 billion is quite a bit. It's the greatest number we've ever seen. Relative to the size of the stock market, it's greater than what we had at the market peak in 2007. It's greater than what we had at the market peak in 2000. And it's even greater as a percentage of both stock market capitalization and GDP at the time, going back to 1929. What I'm saying is there is more speculative dollars in the stock market today than there was at the end of the roaring 20s leading up to 28 and 29, when it seemed like the sure bet, the only sure bet, the place where you could make your gazillions was the stock market, and you didn't even have to use your own money. That's where we are today.
Well, unless we sound like negative Nancys, Dave, I know you talked at this meeting about opportunities that are going to start coming about. And before we get to the opportunities, because anytime there's a market move, especially if prices go back to real numbers, you start to get opportunities for the person who's looking and for the person who stayed liquid and safe enough to have some money to go ahead and buy. But what I want to talk about before you get into the opportunities as we wrap up are some of the things that would accelerate this move back to norm, okay, normal pricing. I'm thinking of the currency war, the derivative trading, the defaults. All of these things amplify the downside and make the prices better when the time comes.
Part of the reason we want to spend a little bit of time in China is the changes that are occurring right now, which are an escalation of the currency war, are one of the most significant things that can occur in any business cycle or when you're looking at the markets in general. You look at monetary policy and you look at liquidity flows, and these things are the determining factors of asset prices in a given period of time.
Right.
And monetary policy or liquidity flows are very significant. And what we're suggesting is the changes that are occurring in China, they have a major impact, not only to other emerging markets, where you could see financial asset prices become very, very volatile. They already have been to some degree, but they can be exaggerated even more so. But you also see, as a consequence of one central bank changing monetary policy, extreme foreign exchange variance and volatility. And ultimately, you may see a return to the world pre-globalization of capital controls being the common element, where because there's so much money flowing and it's destabilizing in its effects, governments just basically say, well, throw up the walls. We're not going to have liberalized trade. We're not going to have the free flow of capital. We're going to try to stem the tide of exit, which is creating things like volatility in our stock and bond markets and massive devaluation in our currency markets.
Well, one thing that's made this period of time so different than any other time in our careers, Dave, is central banks have always manipulated prices to a degree, or various entities have manipulated things. But what we've had is a coherence. We've had an agreement amongst the countries, including China. We've never seen this kind of agreement before, but you said something the other night that I thought was really profound. It looks like China's leadership, there's some disagreement there. And so we've got some wild cards that could be played. You know, you're seeing emergency interventions in the market, and you're starting to see this coherence break down to where you don't see the same kind of cooperation probably that we did even a month ago.
On the one hand, you've got consolidation of power. And, you know, better than 40 generals, their heads have rolled, not literally, but certainly from their positions on corruption charges and whatnot here in recent months. And the guys who participated in the Deng Xiaoping transformation of China and have made billions personally in the process, they are being looked at by some in the Politburo as a problem. And the solution is get them out and get them out of the way. So this re-centralization and greater inclination towards control, that's one thematic. On the other hand, you've got, again, an attempt at greater liberalization in terms of currency control, not pegging their currency to the dollar in the same strict manner they had, trying to introduce more of a free trade with the yuan, which, of course, is part of what is causing it to move down in value. This is an interesting juxtaposition because it looks like two different camps within the Politburo angling for different outcomes. And I could be incorrect about that, but it appears to me that there's some conflict behind the scenes.
Well, I know in meeting with this investor group, you talked about opportunities that you're looking at, actually some opportunities that you're taking advantage of right now and positioning for. Can you share some of those?
You know, some of this is just sort of a perspective on asset allocation. And, you know, for a long time, we've thought, yeah, it makes sense to be heavy on the cash side and heavy on the gold and precious metals side. And a part of it is because we don't buy what is being given to us as an information feed from Bloomberg, from CNBC, from, frankly, governments that are putting together numbers, many of which are very, very suspect. And, you know, what we are going to deal with in the future are the ramifications of changing monetary policy and liquidity flows. And what does that look like? Well, for the person who has cash, it looks very, very interesting. For the person who has gold, a financial asset, which is essentially outside of the financial system, different from other assets which have tremendous amount of counterparty risk and exposure in terms of systemic risk, we think there's going to be tremendous opportunity. Let's just take a case in point. You know, the Mexican stock market, the Brazilian stock market, the Peruvian stock market in Chile, South Korea, Taiwan, Malaysia, Australia, Indonesia, these are countries that are coming under intense pressure as a result of the Chinese devaluation and will continue to be under pressure as time goes on, not only in their currency markets, but in their bond and stock markets as well. Well, think about the option value of cash. And how you diversify your cash position is really the difference between whether or not you have greenbacks or gold and silver ounces. We're talking about a vast cash hoard just split up between a paper promise to pay, which is okay, but only to a certain degree, and then ounces, which you can take to the bank as something that have never in the history of man gone to zero. So what is the option value of cash, however you hold your cash? The option value of cash works something like this. If I stepped into the market and bought shares of General Electric, not that this is the greatest company in the world, but if I bought shares of General Electric, say at $30 per share, some value of cash can be put to work and you can buy X number of shares right now at $30. My suggestion is that the option value of cash is apparent when you can own 2, 3, 4, 5 times the number of shares coming from a cash position to a deflated asset price.
So in other words, staying in cash at this point, let this thing fall and then go back in and buy.
This has nothing to do with sort of the sky is falling, therefore get out of the system and never return. The point is there are extremes in terms of market volatility given crises that are precipitated by monetary policies, precipitated by liquidity flows and capital flows. And if you are not out of the system to some degree, that is your gold and silver position, and still in the system, but with liquid assets, that is your greenback or choose your currency position, you will not be able to take advantage of assets selling at cheaper prices. What we expect over the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months is problems to crop up in the derivatives market, problems to crop up, which are already apparent in terms of defaults, both in terms of governments and corporations. And what these things do is they cause a market to reassess risk. And in spite of interest rates being sat on, in spite of manipulation of the VIX futures, in spite of gold as a barometer of risk being broken deliberately by central bank activism, what we will see is a reassessment of risk, which will bring foreign exchange markets into a very, very chaotic and volatile environment. What will that do to asset values, both stock and bonds? I think stocks and bonds are going to be eviscerated. Is that an 18-month time frame, a 24-month time frame, or within the next 2 weeks? I don't know, but the context is perfectly set for it.
And you're not alone. You know, Albert Edwards of Société Générale, and I quote, this is what he just recently said. He said, we, speaking of Société Générale, expect the acceleration of emerging market devaluations to send waves of deflation to the West to overwhelm already struggling corporate profitability and to take us back into outright recession as investors realize yet another recession beckons without any normalization, either of interest rates or fiscal imbalances in this cycle. Expect a financial market rout every bit as large as 2008. So you're not alone on that.
Well, let me just say that he may be alone. When he says we, maybe he's not talking about Society General.
Oh, okay.
Maybe that's the royal we, which is another way of politely saying I.
Right.
Because every Wall Street firm has their token bear, and he is their token bear. But I think he's right. I think there is a major market reappraisal coming, and it is related to interest rate and fiscal imbalances. Yes, it's related to emerging market devaluations. And the fear, which has been absent from the marketplace, I think is going to come back with a vengeance. I do think we are beginning to see pockets of value emerge. And for the person with cash and liquid assets in the form of gold, I mean, again, Druckenmiller doesn't move to gold because he's a gold bug.
Right.
He moves to gold, I think, because he sees problems with the system. It's the same sort of major purchase that we began to see in 2008, 9, 10, and 11, as investors would take not $100,000, not $250,000, but $1 million here, $5 million there, $50 million there, and own their gold. You remember our conversation with Bill King.
Right.
This is where they just say, no, I want some insurance. I don't like what I see. And you know what? Those major interests have been sitting on their gold ever since. They don't care. They don't care that they paid $1,500, $1,600, $900, whatever the case may be.
They're just quietly accumulating.
It's insurance and you want it. Why do you want it? You want insurance because, as Albert Edwards says, emerging market devaluation sends waves of deflation to the West to overwhelm an already struggling corporate profitability. What are the ramifications for an investment community that is caught short, finding that they had too much confidence in their central banks and those central banks' ability to reflate the system? when the reflation of the world economy is considered a failure by the general public, then I think you look at gold in a very, very different way. Do you want to be buying gold in that environment? Absolutely not. You know why? Because it's already priced for the moon. This is what happens. People try to do the right thing at the very last minute,
right,
and it ends up costing them quite a bit for just delaying the process. Better to be early than a day late. Better to be 2 minutes early than 1 minute late. Better to be 3 years early than 1 minute late. What's next? I think there is tremendous opportunities, whether it is being short the market or ultimately allocating assets to the long side of the market. If you have a significant position in cash and a significant position in metals, I think you're perfectly poised to put those assets to work for you in productive assets in the years ahead. And I think you're going to be able to do it not only here in the U.S. markets, but in the overseas markets, maybe even in the Chinese markets for pennies in the dollar.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.